this Torah portion for Rosh Hashanah through the eyes of three Hasidic commentaries. And they're going to cover both days of Rosh Hashanah. The first one starts at the very beginning of the Parsha for the first day, which is the story of Hagar. And the next two, the third one will be the one that we kind of talked about in the discussion, will be a piece of discussion that you'll see how it relates to what we were talking about before. So I will share our screen. And again, as always, if you like, this has already been sent to you over email. If you're not on the email group, feel free to email me or put into the chat that your email address, and I'll add you to the email group. I think everybody here's in it though. So, so we're looking at this week's the portion for Rosh Hashanah, and we start off with the text of Genesis 20:17, which is actually background information to the first line of our Torah portion, but it's essential, and then we'll keep going from there. Okay, so. The Torah tells us in chapter 20, verse 17, Vayitpalel Avraham el ha-Elohim, vayirape Elohim et Avimelech ve'et ishto, v'amhotav vayeldu. Avraham then prayed to God, and God healed Avimelech and his wife and his slave girls so that they bore children. Okay, I need to explain that just by itself. Some of you have skipped over this story in the Torah probably 1,000 times because it's in a Torah portion which is full of other stuff which is way more interesting. So the Torah portion that precedes Vayera, which is the Torah portion of Lech Lecha, is the Torah portion where we learn that God has come to Abraham and said, go to a land that I will show you, right? The very back end of the story, Abraham and Sarah have a famine, and they go down to Egypt. And when they get there, the king of Egypt says, hey, who's a pretty girl on your arm? And Abraham goes, oh, she's my sister. And he takes her into the house. And there's the implication that some hanky-panky is supposed to take place. But something bad happens. And suddenly, Avimelech's entire house is kind of plagued with illness. And the illness, as the Torah tells us, includes infertility for all the women. So the implication here is that this is a many weeks long story, although we don't get a time frame for it. And then Avimelech says, something's wrong here. That woman you gave to me is my sister. All this crazy stuff started happening as soon as I took her as my wife, whatever that means. And Abraham comes clean and says, well, actually, she's not my sister. She's not my sister. She's technically sort of my sister by family. She's like my half-sister, but really she's my wife. And at that point, the story tells us, just closing the door so that you don't have to hear the ratcheting of my new microwave. At that point, the Torah tells us that Avimelech, this part that we just read, which is that Avimelech's women and his maidservants were all now fertile again. So there's also an interesting juxtaposition in this story where Sarah has caused infertility to other women. And in the next story, we of course find out that Sarah has been infertile her entire life and is incapable of bearing children herself. So that's very interesting, right? But not something we're going to discuss here. But the Torah continues two lines later and says the following. Varonai pakad et Sarah ka'asher amar vayas Adonai l'sa'a ka'asher diber. The Lord took note of Sarah as God had promised, and the Lord did for Sarah as God had spoken. So this earlier moment where, you know, earlier in the Torah, God came to Abraham and said, circumcise yourself, follow one God, and I will make your children as numerous as the stars in the sky and the sand of the sea. And by the way, Sarah, change your name, Sarai, change your name to Sarah, and I will give you children, right? At this point, Sarah is 97 years old, and she starts laughing, right? And our Torah starts out in this portion by saying, and God took note of Sarah, and she conceived, right? And so at this point, we've got this kind of strange little moment. So our commentary is going to be very interested in this Vadonai Pakad et Sarah. So in the relationship between it and the thing that happened before. So Rashi, the central commentator who is from medieval Spain in the 11th century, he's the commentary to basically every verse in the Torah in every major work that you will study Torah. Rashi says this: the Torah places this section after the preceding one to teach that whoever prays for mercy on behalf of another, when he himself also is in need of that very thing for which he prays on the other's behalf, will himself first receive a favorable response from God. For it is said at the end of the last chapter, and this is our verse from before, and Abraham prayed for Avimelech and his wife, and they brought forth. And immediately afterwards, it states here, and the Lord remembered Vadonai Pakad Sarah. He had already remembered her before he healed Avimelech. And that's a line from the Talmud in Bava Kamma. So Rashi's picking up on a weird thing, which is that the two sections of Torah are related to each other. But rather than riffing on the idea that I had, which is that these are two parallel stories about Sarah's infertility, there's actually a relationship between prayer, right? But what is the relationship between prayer? Because in the Avimelech story, God, Abraham prays to God, and suddenly Abraham and his family are capable of conceiving children. And immediately following, Sarah is capable of conceiving children. So the Talmud and Bava Kamma, and related to that, Rashi, then say, well, those two things are related. Abraham prays on behalf of another person, and then something good happens to Abraham. So we're going to see one short commentary about that that I find really interesting, one of our favorites. So Rabbi Simcha Bunim of Pshisacha was a third generation chassid, a student of the students of the Baal Shem Tov, said the following: and he himself is also in need of that very thing, that one's friend is deficient in that thing. This is to say, it would benefit him that his fellow would not be healed. All right, so what's going on here? So there's a very clever little move that Simcha Bunim is doing, which is that Avimelech is, at least the Torah understands him to be, something of a tyrant and a bad guy, right? Abraham comes down to Egypt. He's so terrified of the potentate that he would be, and our medieval commentators elucidate this further, that when Avimelech turns to Abraham and says, hey, who's the pretty lady on your arm? Abraham immediately replies, she's my sister. And the reason that our commentators believe that that's the reason he said it is because had Abraham said, she is my wife, the commentators believe very strongly that Avimelech would have killed Abraham and immediately taken Sarah as his wife. But to say my sister, he didn't need to kill her. He could just be like, oh, well, then can I borrow her for a little while? And Abraham goes, yeah, she's yours, right? Forget the modern feminist overtones of this entire thing, right? The problematic issues of men handing over women to each other and then praying for fertility, right? That's a hot mess by itself, but we'll leave that aside because I can't reclaim 12th century medieval French ideas about sexism without, you know, completely throwing out Hasidic commentaries completely. So I have to have some cognitive dissonance in order to get this text across, for better or for worse. You can send me an angry email later, and I'm okay with that. But so the idea here is that this question, which is the problem that Simcha Bunim is having, is that Abraham prays for Avimelech. And the weird thing about that is, why would Abraham even pray for Avimelech? He's a bad dude, right? He would basically be a murderer and a rapist were it not for the beneficence of Abraham. And so it's this very weird thing. So he keeps going. For example, Avimelech, that he should not say that from him Sarah was made pregnant, right? There's this weird thing that Rashi just did. Rashi says, Abraham prayed for Avimelech, parenthetically, who is a bad guy, right? And then good things happen to Avimelech. And then, of course, good things happen to Abraham. And that's weird for Simcha Bunim. Simcha Bunim's like, why are we praying for Avimelech? He's a lousy dude. Why would he get schar? Why would he get merit off of the prayer that he did for a bad dude? And he keeps going. This is why this is such a neat text. It's very terse, though. Simcha Bunim doesn't really add a lot of words here. I had to pull a lot out in order to make this make sense. If with all this, a person can conquer their inclination and pray on behalf of them, behold, their prayer will be answered first. So this is a really good text for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Because what just happened here is that Simcha Bunim went super deep. He basically said, listen, there's a lot of bad people in the world, or there are a lot of people, better put, who do lousy things, to us. You know, we've had a rough year, all of us. And some of the reasons that the year has been rough is because there are bad people who have done dumb or bad things, or thoughtless things, or careless things. Some of that is on a national level, and some of that is an interpersonal level, right? You know, you may have a friend or a relative who said something, you know, in the heat of the moment that was hurtful. And this also applies year-round and every year for high holidays, that we are often dealing with people who mistreat us. Do you pray for them? Should you pray for a person who has deeply harmed you, deeply wounded you? And Simcha Bunim, in a very Hasidic way, is saying, yeah. And his answer is not only Rashi's answer. Rashi's answer is, if you pray for another person, then good things will come to you next, right? There's like a filter that comes through that, like, you're, it's even maybe a magnifier. If you pray for others, then the same blessing will come to you, right? Abraham prays for the health and the healing of Avimelech, and specifically regarding infertility, and therefore Sarah becomes healed of her infertility. But Simcha Bunim is magnifying it by saying, even people who are lousy, can you pray for a person who's lousy? And can you forgive them? And find love in your heart to transcend your own yucky feelings? And he uses the word your yetzer, that you're kovesh your yatzro, that you conquer your inclination. The inclination is usually in Hasidic thought of as the inclination of evil, the evil inclination. Here it's much, I wouldn't call it evil. I would call it much more subtle than that. It's your inclination not to forgive. It's your inclination to be mad at someone who legitimately sucks, by the way, right? Avimelech legitimately sucks. He's a legitimately bad dude. And to find that kind of space in your heart to hold out and think, like, I will pray on their behalf. Not necessarily you forgive them. Not necessarily you say, I suddenly don't think they're a bad guy anymore, right? You can disagree with someone deeply in terms of their politics and their praxis and still find it in your heart to pray for them, right? This sounds a little weird because it feels a little bit Christian, right? Oh, I'll pray for them. Bless her heart, right? But Hasidim often cross over into some of the aspects that we often align with Christianity because they live in a world that is deeply imbued with prayer on other people's behalf, non-judgment, and love, that they're trying to transcend. The concept of turn the other cheek is not a Jewish concept, but in the Hasidic world, there are a lot of very similar rationalizations that having a concept of loving another person so much that you can transcend their ill deeds is a really big Hasidic idea. All right. If anybody has any kind of comments on that text, I think that's a really good one for High Holidays by itself. But it's a useful one. Marilyn, did you want to say something?
I just wanted to ask you to enlarge the print.
Yes, I will do that. I will do that.
Struggling to read. I broke my glasses. I'm wearing my substitute glasses, so it's even harder. Thank you.
Yeah, you got it. All right, we'll do the next text. Thank you so much for that request. Tanya added, if you pray for someone and you have the same need, Hashem will bless you both. That's exactly the idea that Rashi brings. The idea that Simcha Bunim is bringing is even bigger, which is if you pray for someone that's lousy, it will magnify the deed for both of you. It's, by the way, it's a very weird counterintuitive one. But the other one I was going to link to High Holidays is, and you all probably know this, when we start beating our chests for the vidui, for the confession of our sins, we don't do it individually. We don't say, I sinned, I am guilty, I'm a bad person. We say, we sinned, we are guilty, we are a bad person, right? I mean, every year I get to the section where, you know, in the translation, because there's an alphabetical acrostic in English on your page, there's the we are xenophobic. And I always think to myself, I am the least xenophobic person you'll ever meet. I love people from foreign countries, right? I'm actually xenophobic against Americans, if anything, right? I love French people. I love Moroccans. I love Sudanese, right? Like, I'm fascinated by other cultures. I think America, you know, like, they think, like, you know, the height of culture in America is, like, cheeseburgers. But, you know, that's not true. I listen to blues music all morning. And, like, you know, when you listen to really good blues, you think to yourself, like, oh, we invented this. America is a cultural paragon. But anyways, point being, like, you know, the we, that we pray for the we in this prayer, and that it magnifies our prayer for the I, is a really nice idea. All right, I will, we'll move on to the next text, and I will also magnify and glorify the text. Okay, let's see if I can get it. Here we go. It's pretty big now, right? It's pretty big now. Okay, good. Remember, whenever you don't like how big the text is, you could also go and to the original text. But I know that the share screen thing works pretty well. So from here, we're moving on to the next story in the Torah. So this is, so that was the last text I taught you is about Rosh Hashanah day one. So when you're bored in synagogue on Rosh Hashanah day one, that's the text you pull out again. And remember, you all have shared access to this document. Rosh Hashanah day two is the story of Abraham and Isaac going up the mountain for the sacrifice of Isaac, or what is referred to in the Torah. In English, we call it the sacrifice of Isaac. In Hebrew, the term is Akedat Yitzchak, or the binding of Isaac, which is, you know, a very, probably a better way of understanding it, in the sense that we don't actually sacrifice Isaac. And for many of the commentators, they don't think there was ever going to be a sacrifice of Isaac. It was just that Isaac was brought up and bound. Now, the commentaries all disagree about what was going on in that story. Whatever was going on in that story, it is problematic, right? One of my favorite words. All rabbis love the word problematic. But there's a lot of interesting things going on in this story. The broader context of the story, of course, is troubling, right? The concept of a father nearly sacrificing his son. But there are little moments in the story which are interesting. And our commentary, our Hasidic commentary, it's actually a pre-Hasidic commentary, is going to pick up on one of those little moments. And it's very weird and intricate, but I found it amazing. I found this to be a really amazing, this is a very Maryland text in the sense that it's got a lot of, it's very literary, right? There's a bunch of literary creativity in it. It's got some sci-fi-ness to it. For those of you who are more Jewish law nerds, I don't know if I have any Jewish law nerds in this class, but for those who are really interested in halakha, maybe Audrey's the most kind of legalistic. Although when Dan is here, I feel like Dan kind of jives with this kind of stuff. It kind of fits in neatly because there's a legal problem which is presented by our text. Okay, so the text begins, the story starts off with Abraham taking his two sons, right, Isaac and Ishmael, and taking them up the mountain with a knife and some wood for an altar. And we're not really exactly told what's going to happen, but because we read this story twice a year, every year, we all know this, where this is going. So the story starts off with them going up the mountain, and then we get this point after they started hiking. Bayom hashlishi vayisa Avraham et enav vayyar et hamakom merachok. Interesting. On the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place from afar. So you could do a ton of fun stuff with the words with the character Abraham and what Rabbi Adelson would refer to as the Leitvort. The reason I don't use the word Leitvort is because it's a very JTS word. In rabbinical school, I was taught this is a motif. Rabbi Adelson would have been taught on the East Coast that it's a Leitvort, a recurring thematic word, which calls to mind a certain thing. The leitwort of this text is the word of Vayar or Vayera, and he saw, right? So seeing is a big thing with Abraham. Abraham sees and is seen more than almost any commentator, any patriarch or matriarch in the Torah. And here he's seeing a place, the place, from afar. So like somehow there's the story, one of the weirdnesses of the story is God says to Abraham, go up the mountain and I will eventually show you a place where a thing is going to happen, right? So Abraham basically is told, take some stuff and these two guys and go that way. And then I'll tell you some more stuff later, right? It's like how you ask for directions in Israel. When you go to Israel, you meet someone and you say, how do I get to the central bus station? They'll say, take a right and a left and a left and a right and go straight and then go past and then go straight and then ask another person. And then that's directions in Israel. So you don't actually know where you're going. You know how to get a little closer. Okay, so that's what happens with Abraham. So our commentator, it looks like a long commentary, but it's actually not, because most of it's story material. So the commentary is going to play with this idea of what Abraham sees. And why it's such a strange place. All right, so our rabbis understand the verse via a midrash, that Abraham saw the place was a valley, was an omek, and not a mountain, not a har. And he prayed, the glory of the king is not such that it should dwell in a valley, parenthetically, and in the future that the Beit HaMikdash will be built in that place. And it was made on that day into a mountain, according to the Torah, quote, which he said on that day, the mountain of the Lord has vision. Okay, so a little weird, but what just happened? So God says to, according to the Midrash, remember the Midrash is a series of stories that come after the Torah to make a little bit more sense of the Torah. The Midrash is asking the question, why do they go a certain distance and then we see the place, but we're not told we see Mount Moriah? Okay, because we know in the modern day two things about the place that Abraham sacrifices Isaac, almost sacrifices Isaac. Thing one, it was a mountain. Thing two, in future days, God would tell David, build the temple on this, or to Solomon, more correctly, build the temple on this location, because this is the spot where Abraham nearly sacrificed Isaac. By the way, if you go to the Dome of the Rock, I have been to the Dome of the Rock once. If you go to the Dome of the Rock, for Muslims, that is believed to be the location of two things. One, Muhammad arose to heaven on a horse on a midnight ride at that location. And two, in the Quran, Abraham nearly sacrifices Ishmael on the rock, right? So the Dome of the Rock is covering the rock that Jews believe Abraham nearly sacrifices Isaac. Fascinating, right? That these two religions have the same book and the same story. They just switch up the patriarch that's involved. So the problem that Abraham has in our story, according to the Midrash, is God says to Abraham, hey, see that spot down there? That's where the thing is going to happen. And Abraham's response to God is, I can't do the thing there. We're going to build the temple there someday. And we can't build the temple in a valley. The temple's got to be built on a mountain. And God goes, oh yeah, you're right. Let me make it a mountain today. And so God goes, and turns it into a mountain, right? And the valley turns into a mountain. And Abraham looks at God and goes, oh, we're good now. I can climb that and we can do the sacrifice now. And then later on, like the temple will be built there, right? Problem solved, which is all of that, by the way, is already ridiculous in its own right, but we're going to leave it at that, okay? It's a great story in a very strange way. But wait, there's more, right? That would have been enough, but no, I'm going to keep going. So it continues. On a related note to the words is the response of Rabbi Natan Adler of Frankfurt on Main. I have to just share one little dorky thing with you about this. In the text in the Hebrew, there's an acronym, and it is the weirdest acronym I've ever seen in my 15 years as a rabbi, okay? It says, the name in the Hebrew says, Ba'akavut dvarehem tirut Rabbi Natan Adler, mem pei pei dalad chubchik mem. It is an acronym with five letters in it that I have never seen before. And the acronym with five letters in it is Meh Frankfurt de Main. They're literally, I guess Frankfurt on Main was such an important city at some point that you could literally like write it down as an acronym like NYC or LA back in the day. A five-letter acronym for Frankfurt on Main. By the way, Frankfurt, you know, I do know to be in the, from the 12th to the 15th century, was the center of Jewish life. In fact, the phrase that it was most associated with, it was kind of the center of Ashkenaz. So Ashkenazi Jews really come from that region of Germany from that time. Okay. Anyhow, Rabbi Natan Adler of Frankfurt on Main. Rabbi Natan Adler was a rabbi who lived in the 1500s and 1600s, the 1600s and 1700s. He lived in Frankfurt, and he was a German Kabbalist who was deeply criticized, apparently, for sharing Kabbalah that ought not to be shared with the masses. So that was Rabbi Natan Adler. And he has a problem based on a verse in the Talmud Yerushalmi, one of the books of the, one of the alternate versions of the Talmud. And he says this: how could the Beit HaBechira, that's a fancy word for the temple, have been built on Mount Moriah? For have we not learned in Talmud Avodah Zarah, every place that one goes out to and sees a tall mountain or a raised hillock or a gorgeous tree, you know that it was a place of idolatry. Does not our halakha say it is forbidden to worship in a place where an idolatrous item or an altar was affixed upon high? Ah, so now we have a problem, right? So the beginning of the story is the Midrash says Abraham was going to sacrifice Isaac in a valley, right? No problem. Abraham objects and says, we can't sacrifice on a valley. We've got to sacrifice on a mountain. Great. Problem solved. Okay. Rebuttal. Rabbi Natan, Natan Adler says, you can't sacrifice them on a mountain because mountains are places where idolaters worship. You can't take them up there and do idol worship. That's not okay. So maybe there's a solution to this, right? Which is inside the Midrash, which was, it wasn't a mountain before. It was a valley. It's a valley. It's a mountain. It's a mountain. It's a valley. Who knows, right? Solve the problem. Okay. He continues. The meaning of the words of the Midrash are not a mystery. For all the other mountains upon which idol worship was done before Abraham our father claimed the land were forbidden as high places. However, Mount Moriah was a valley beforehand, and idolaters were unable to pray there, right? They saw there was no thing. For after Abraham claimed it and prayed there, it rose up into a mountain. And afterward, I got a sign for my microwave. Hang on, everybody.
I was trying to keep it quiet. So
no, you're good. You could have knocked.
I did, but I was knocking lately.
Are we all done?
Yep.
I have a microwave.
Yep.
It works and everything.
Yep. He's getting it all, doing cleanup and everything now. So
cool.
Welcome to come down and check it out.
Cool. Let's go see the microwave, everybody. In the middle of this important commentary on Abraham and also buying a microwave or getting one installed. The modern world, guys. All right, guys, take a look at the brand new microwave.
Ta-da!
Ta-da! Right. Thanks, man.
I got a copy here for you. I'll just leave it right here.
Awesome. Thank you.
Another thing.
Yeah.
Well, you're going to get a survey asking you how me and my partner did, not based off of your plans or how it works or anything like that, but based off how I did.
Yep.
If you can give me a fat, I would really appreciate it. Keep my family eating and be working.
What's your name?
Jerome.
Jerome. Everyone say thank you, Jerome. The whole Zoom class says thank you. Thanks, guys. All right. So where was I? We were talking about Abraham going up the mountain. So, So the text continues. For after Abraham claimed it and prayed there, it rose up into a mountain. And afterward, it could not become forbidden. As it is taught, a person cannot forbid a thing that does not belong to them. So we have this wild commentary that basically says it was a valley, and that kept the idolaters from praying there. Then it becomes a mountain, and Abraham can pray there, right? And then now it belongs to Abraham. So it can't go back to being an idolatrous place, even though between Abraham and Solomon, any number of things could have happened at that place. So why do I bring us this text? Like, what can I do with this text? What can you do with this text on Rosh Hashanah? I think one of the things that's interesting about this is it raises a parallel idea to the previous text that we looked at, which is a thing that is invalidated or is bad or is profane can be reclaimed, right? In our lives, we have yuckinesses, we have failures, we have sins, and we can reclaim them. The valleys of our lives can stay valleys. The worst things in our lives can stay the worst things. Or we can make them into mountains, right? We can find a way to elevate them so that they are such that they are a high place for us. Because idolatry is the worst thing in Judaism. And so on some level, this text is about the magical transition of a place that was the worst thing possible in Judaism, and it's flipped into the holiest site in Judaism, right? A place of idol worship can be magically transformed through request into a sacred and holy place. I find that to be a really neat text. You have to pull it apart a lot. This isn't a complicated one, but I find that to be a really remarkable kind of idea. Okay, any comments or thoughts off of this one before we go to our final text, which is actually going to bring in the topic that we started the day with? Again, thanks everybody for bearing with me in the microwave, guys. They're nice, right? Okay. So we're going to keep going. We'll do the final text. For those of you who stick strictly to the belief that this class is a one-hour class, if you need to go, we'll count this the bonus text. But, you know, I really count this as a class that sort of starts at like 120-ish and goes to like 130-ish. Maybe it's my fault as a teacher. I can't stop myself. All right, so our final bit is from this last piece in the text. It's kind of the big payoff moment, the pinnacle of the text, which is the moment at which Abraham is about to, the word here is lishchot. The translation is often to slaughter. I find that word really icky, so I prefer the word kill, but it's not really what lishchot means, because the root word lishchot, of course, is also the root of the word shchita, which is to butcher an animal in a kosher way, right? So this word is really associated with slaughter on behalf of an offering, right? Super icky. Okay. And the text continues with this really interesting kind of thing, which sometimes I think our rabbis like to spend a lot of time on. Other years, you will skate over this and completely forget that it happens. So, Vishlach Avraham et Yado v'yikach et hamalachat Ma'achelet, sorry, lishchot et beno. And Abraham picked up the knife to slay his son. Vayikra elav malach Adonai. And the angel of God called to him from heaven, Abraham, Abraham. And he answered, here I am. And it said, the malach, the angel, do not raise your hand against the boy or do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your favored one, from me. So a bazillion things going on here, lots of fascinating, interesting commentaries on all of these verses. You could have 100,000 sermons on just those three lines. We're just going to deal with one little problem or one little question. And the question is a specific one. So Rabbi Meir Leibush, the Malbim, who is a non-Hasidic, post-Hasidic rabbi, he's just kind of a more modern commentary, right? And by modern, I mean mid-1800s, right? Gotta love Judaism, where modern means the 1800s. He asks a simple question, and his question is, who was this angel? So what is that question, for starters? Well, so just a little bit of context about angels within Jewish theology. There are kind of two different types of angels. There are named angels and there are unnamed angels. So there are a number of named angels that you may be familiar with, right? Michael, Gabriel, right? So those are some of the angels that we know of regarding healing, or that we specially kind of associate with specific kinds of prayers. Another one that's famous is Metatron, kind of the supreme angel who becomes like all powerful and leads to some theological problems in the Torah, in the Talmud, sorry. There's a number of other named angels. Basically like Christianity deals with a lot of them more so than Judaism. But then there's a whole bunch of unnamed angels. And later on, the Talmud basically says that for each and every act that God does in the world, God creates an angel to do that. And it's basically a disposable angel, right? You've got your glasses, which you've got all the time. And then you've got your disposable one-day contacts, which you use and you throw away. Angels come in both varieties, right? There's the permanent angels, and then there's the, you know, one-day astigmatic angels who you toss out after one use. So, you know, the sun rises, the angel of sunrise this morning came, lifted the sun up above the horizon for us, and then poof, that angel was done, right? There's a person who needs healing. The angel comes down, the angel provides healing for that person, they get a little better, and poof, the angel disappears, right? That's another kind of angel. There is a famous line in the Talmud that says, for each and every blade of grass in the universe, there is an angel standing over it that says, grow, grow. So like just the process of photosynthesis for each and every blade of grass, according to the Talmud, involves a separate angel, which is a really cool little idea, right? I remember another rabbi once asking kind of a question, is gravity an angel? Like, it's a force of nature? Do gravitational pulls, are those like, you know, a bunch of angels, you know, tugging on ropes? Like, what is that? So I don't know, fun stuff. So the question is like, what kind of angel was this that did this? And what was the nature of that angel? So the Malbim, Rabbi Meir Leibush, whose Yahrzeit is Rosh Hashanah, the first of Tishrei, interesting, said this: this angel is simply a malach, an angel, that was created for this mitzvah alone, the binding of Isaac, and was completed with the ascension of the offering. Now, the ascension of the offering here is probably the moment at which Abraham and Isaac get to the altar, like the going up the mountain, right? That like, so the question is a really interesting one, which is twofold. What kind of angel did this act? And what was the act that the angel was technically tasked with? By the way, that's a deep question, because underlying that question is the deepest question of this entire Torah portion, which is, did God intend for Abraham to slaughter Isaac or not? And the rabbis come down differently. Right? Many rabbis say there was never any intent to slaughter Isaac. Some rabbis say there was an intent, but God was pleased by the outcome nonetheless, right? And others, actually, there's a midrash that says, actually, this whole thing was Satan. Satan was the one who was trying to get Abraham to kill Isaac. It's a fascinating kind of separate one. But Meir Leibush is basically arguing the Malach's role here is not to be there to slaughter, and not even really to interrupt, but technically his job was, yo, your job is to take Abraham and Isaac up the mountain and show them the spot. That's it. That's your job, angel. All right, then it continues. Had Abraham killed his son, he would have been judged as a murderer and not as one who had fulfilled the will of God. So what's being implied here is the angel's job was to get Abraham to the spot. It was Abraham's job to then decide what to do, not the angels. So somehow the Malbim is understanding that Abraham is the one who is deciding not to kill Isaac. And somehow the angel is intuiting that moment and then saying it out loud, right? Abraham's basically like, I'm not going to kill Isaac. And the angel pops in and goes, you're not going to kill Isaac. And Abraham's like, that's what I was saying, right? The angel's job was not to stop him, according to Malbim. The angel's job was just to get him to that place so that he could have the free will to make the decision on his own. The moment that the angel was responsible for was a small moment. It was just walking up a mountain. The big moment was created by the small moment. Very interesting. He keeps going. For his command was only in bringing him up and not actually to slaughter him and as an offering. To slaughter him and bring him up as an offering. Sorry. And with the canceling of the mitzvah, the angel was nullified from existence. For this, the angel was called to stop this act, right? So perhaps, now that I read the back end, you could argue, or you could say, that the angel's job was twofold, right? Bring him up and then stop him. And then he's done. And then that's it, right? He ceases to exist. So this gets me back to my point that I kind of brought up with my son, Iggy, in our conversation about moments and existentialism, right? The angels here are, you know, we think of angels often as holier than humans. And yet our angel in this story is temporal. It exists but for this purpose and then ceases to exist. Human existence can also be thought of by similar terms in the sense that instead of us thinking of our lives as the sum total of our Wikipedia, right? The sum total of the greatest exploit we ever have, or the most important book we ever write, or the most famous act we ever did, or for me, for instance, last week, my important appearance in one line in the New York Times, right? Which people, you know, pointed out all week, like, oh, Rabbi, you were in the New York Times. It's like, yes, yes, that is a big deal. But the moment I have with my son is a bigger deal, right? The millions of moments I have with my daughter and my son and my wife and my friends, you know, my drinking of coffee in the morning when it's a really liminal moment, right? A really good Amidah. The moment that I finish the blessing over my tefillin. They're all moments. And each moment is a moment, right? Each moment is a mitzvah. And either I am created just for that moment, or there is an angel created just for that moment. And it is equally sacred and holy. And the existence of the moment is just as important as the existence of all moments together, right? My life is not the sum total of the most important thing I ever did. My life and your life is each and every moment strung together and made important. Rosh Hashanah on some level is that, right? That's what Rosh Hashanah is a reminding that this is a big moment, but the big moment is just a reminder that it's just a collection of all your small moments, that every small moment of your life is relevant and is important. So I bless us with that. I bless us all with a great year that we go into 5781 with that kind of sense of purpose and meaning that all of the moments of our life are equally relevant and deeply beloved and deeply special. And I very much hope that you have had a great 5780. And thanks for coming to class today. I'll stick around, don't worry, so that you can all kind of join in. And-